From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump is continuing his blitz against Special Counsel Robert Mueller. In a tweet this morning, Trump called Mueller's appointment totally unconstitutional. He also said that he has, quote, the absolute right to pardon myself. But why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong? This comes after a newly disclosed letter from Trump's lawyers, which argues the president could refuse a subpoena to testify as part of Mueller's investigation. There are also some important rulings today from the Supreme Court, and Congress is back in session. So let's bring in Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent for NPR's Washington desk. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Peter.
Rudy Giuliani was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday saying that while the president probably has the power to pardon himself, he would not do that. But he also said that Trump has absolute authority over the Justice Department.
The power of the attorney general is a presidential appointee. When I was a U.S. attorney, nobody ever attempted to terminate an investigation. It would have probably been a scandal of immense proportions unless I was being an idiot. So that's a very unrealistic thing. But if you're asking in a theoretical sense, I mean, it could lead to impeachment.
Ron, what are your thoughts about why President Trump and his lawyer are talking about subpoenas and impeachments and all these sorts of things so openly?
To the layman's eye, or perhaps to a lawyer's as well, it certainly looks like the president and his lawyer are discussing responses and legal defenses in anticipation of some kind of a legal assault in the probably very near future, presumably from the Office of the Independent Counsel, whom the president now says is totally unconstitutional. Now, the president continues to assert total innocence, but then to say that he's beyond the reach of the legal system, essentially immune to punishment, which is a remarkable assertion in any event, but would be particularly remarkable coming from someone who were, in fact, innocent.
Exactly. That is very debatable. Now, the president can say whatever he wants to, but there are serious constitutional questions about whether the president actually can pardon himself, as you say. So what are some of the legal arguments that you're hearing there?
This idea of an absolute right of any kind for the president seems quite contradictory to the general mindset of the framers. What they were trying to get around, the founding fathers, was this idea that an absolute monarch had absolute power. That was their objection to King George and to all the other crowned heads of Europe. We were trying to establish a new sense of order in which we would be a nation of laws, not led initially by men and then, of course, by human beings. We were going to be a nation of laws, and no individual person was going to be above the law.
All right, let's talk about another president who also faced a special counsel investigation. Bill Clinton promoting a new book that he's co-written. He went on NBC's Today show and was asked about his past with Monica Lewinsky, which has been brought back into the conversation by this Me Too movement that we're having. And here he is addressing his critics.
A lot of the facts have been conveniently omitted to make the story work, but I think partly because they're frustrated that they got all these serious allegations against the current occupant of the Oval Office, and his voters don't seem to care. I think I did the right thing. I defended the Constitution.
This was a tense interview, and it was remarkable in a way just to hear President Clinton talk so publicly about this.
Yes, and there's really been no reassessment of Bill Clinton on the part of his hardcore or longtime critics. They've always seen him as an abuser, someone who has never been held fully accountable for his relationships with a number of women, not just Monica Lewinsky. But for the larger public, Clinton's image here has been reassessed the way so many other people's have been reassessed in this Me Too era, as you call it. Political figures, business figures, media figures in particular, because we now, as a culture, are giving greater weight to the reports of victims.
Well, look, Congress is back in session. They've got an unusually heavy workload for, you know, the time right after Memorial Day break, including this Republican-led effort to address immigration. We've got about a minute left. What are you watching for there?
We're watching for the efforts on the part of the House Freedom Caucus. This is the most conservative group within the House Republican majority to force some kind of a vote that would give them a chance to show they support the wall and that they support some of the other really strong measures that the Trump administration wants to take against illegal immigration. At the same time, you've got a large group of House moderates who would like to have an argument and have a vote at least, on allowing people who are in this country under DACA, that is the deferred action for people who came here as children, to actually have legal status and perhaps even a path to citizenship. So you have opposing views within the House Republican majority, and they're going to have to try to decide whether or not they can get together and pass something that could be considered in the Senate. Looks pretty steep at this point.
And very quickly, do you think there's going to be a vote on that?
I think there might be a debate and a vote, but I can't see what the House could do that the Senate could accept.
All right. NPR senior Washington desk editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Syria's President Bashar Assad will visit North Korea to meet with its leader, Kim Jong-un. Yes, Bashar Assad, the ruler who's been accused of using chemical weapons against his own citizens. He's been fighting a civil war against rebels who have been trying to oust him since 2011. Ousting Assad is also something many in the West and in the U.S. have said should happen. News about the Assad-Kim meeting was first reported by state-run media in North Korea, which did not say when it will take place. And, of course, the news comes ahead of President Trump's summit with Kim Jong-un, which is scheduled for next Tuesday. Joining us now is Jean Lee, director of the Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Wilson Center. She's in Washington. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
And what do you make of this, that President Assad, who the U.S., at least in the past, had been trying to get rid of in Syria, is going to meet with Kim in North Korea? Is it a surprise?
Well, as far as we know, this has been reported by North Korea's state media and has not been confirmed, though update me if I'm wrong, has not been confirmed by Syria itself. And it's interesting, the context. So North Korean state media reported this when their ambassador was presenting his credentials to Assad in Syria. Mm. And, you know, what we're seeing is this campaign by the North Koreans to present Kim Jong-un as an international statesman. It is surprising for us because it was only last year that he was considered to be this reclusive leader who hadn't met with any foreign leaders, hadn't made a trip to China as had been expected in the past. So we're seeing all of this unfold one after another. But let's just remember that this was reported in North Korea state media. And what they want to do is to tell their people, look how popular and how many foreign leaders want to meet our leader, Kim Jong-un. So it's part of a propaganda campaign.
But who is the target of that propaganda campaign? People in North Korea or people outside North Korea?
Well, both, I would say. So North Korea's state news agency does they do transmit to their people. Mm-hmm. And as well, this is the main news outlet for those of us outside North Korea. So it's really both. If you go on the state news agency's website, there's a whole section called Kim Jong-un's activities. And right now, what you'll see are pictures of him with Xi Jinping of China, with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State of the United States, and with the most recent one, the Russian foreign minister, who made his first trip to Pyongyang since 2009. So it was the first time a foreign minister had been invited to the capital since 2009. So we're just in the midst of this incredible period in the making of Kim Jong-un. And so this fits into that. They want to show one of their oldest allies. They want to show their people that one of their oldest allies wants to send its leader here as well to Pyongyang.
Well, what does it mean for the potential summit next Tuesday between President Trump and Kim Jong-un? I imagine that people in Washington are not so happy to see this development if it in fact is true that Assad is going to visit Kim.
It's an interesting time to be announcing a visit like that. You know, one of the things that I find so striking when I was based in North Korea as the AP bureau chief there was that when I would go to events, often I was surrounded, I used to say I was surrounded by the axis of evil. The Syrian military attaché, the Iranian military attaché, the Cuban military attaché, these were the people that I sat with. As an American journalist, it was a bit chilling for me to realize that I was sitting with so many military officials who were on the other side of the political spectrum and perhaps at a foes of the United States and part of that axis of evil. But it did remind me that North Korea does have relationships with countries that our government is often at odds with. I think it's very sensitive because one of the things that Syria is accused of, or North Korea is accused of, is that these two countries have collaborated on nuclear programs. And this is something, for example, the North Koreans are believed to have helped Syria build a nuclear reactor in northeast Syria starting in the early 2000s. Now, according to Israeli intelligence, this nuclear reactor had a lot of the same facets as North Korea's nuclear reactor in Yongbyon. And so they actually destroyed that reactor before it was fully operational in 2007. And so these ties go way back. And even more recently, there have been signs and accusations that North Korea has been helping Syria in the current conflict.
So not that big of a surprise, perhaps, if in fact this is true, that the Syrian leader and Kim Jong-un will meet. That's Jean Lee, who is director of the Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Wilson Center. Jean, it's going to be interesting to watch what happens next week if there is a summit. Thanks so much.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Here's host Mo Rocca asking the final question from the 30th annual National Geographic Bee last month in Washington, D.C.
Lebanon has a population most similar to which South American country?
Peter, any guesses?
Well, I would have no idea.
Okay. Well, it's Paraguay, and a 13-year-old eighth grader from San Ramon, California got it right. That's Venkat Ranjan. He had the winning answer, earned a $50,000 college scholarship and a lifetime membership in the National Geographic Society and an all-expenses-paid trip to the Galapagos Islands. And Venkat Ranjan joins us now. Venkat, congratulations, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And how did it feel to win?
It felt like really good. It was mostly disbelief. I wasn't really thinking of winning or losing anything. So I was like from the mentality at the beginning, which was I have a 10% chance of winning because there are 10 finalists.
You thought you had an equal chance with each of those finalists. You thought that each of them could have won, and you ended up doing it.
Yeah. I thought that I could win, but I knew that everybody else was just as good as me.
Were you nervous as you got to the final rounds?
Not really. I was just focusing on each question as it came.
And how certain were you about each answer?
Most answers I was like almost 100% sure. But then there are some that I wasn't completely sure. Like, there was one question that I got wrong. I forgot the name of the bird, but that bird spent its summers, I think, in a national monument on the border of the United States and Mexico that was named after a cactus of the same name and named the cactus. And the answer was Oregon pipe cactus.
And you didn't know that?
No.
Have you been in other contests like this before?
Not like the National Geographic Bee.
But other ones you have been in?
Yeah. Like there's the National Science Bowl. It's a team competition, and then my team got second in Nationals last month.
So which is harder, doing the Science Bowl or doing the Geography Bee?
I think they're about equal in difficulty. They just require a little different skills.
How did you first get interested in geography?
I think it was like when I was really, really young, my parents bought me this like globe, talking globe, and you can press buttons on it and it would tell you facts about countries or places.
Facts like what? I'm sure you remember some of them.
I almost completely forgot, but it was like, I think, official language, population, things like that.
And do you prepare for the Geography Bee?
Yeah. But first, I just started by... Like, a few years ago, I started just by, like, gathering general knowledge, but now I do a little more organized study. I make a map of a country and write down a bunch of facts about the country on the side of the map, and then a few weeks later or a few months later, I'll revise that country and everything. I also put a bunch of information in Excel spreadsheets and then quiz myself from that, or ask my mom to quiz me from that.
And you won a $50,000 college scholarship in this case. Do you have any idea where you might want to go to college and what you want to study?
I don't exactly know where, but Stanford or Berkeley would be nice. And I probably want to study physics.
physics.
Yeah.
So you want to get away from the field of geography?
I would like to just keep geography as a hobby, as a very useful hobby.
Do you intend to travel to a lot of these places that you've had to learn about?
Like, I would want to, but I might be busy.
Why? Why would you be so busy?
Because high school's coming down, then I'm just going to be a lot more busy in high school than I am now. And I'm already pretty busy now. So,
if there's somebody listening to this who wants to compete in a Geography Bee and win, like you did, what advice would you give them?
You have to take preparing step by step. You can't just say, I'm going to win nationals, because then you'll have too much on your plate and not enough, and you won't know how to organize anything. First you say, I'll have to win the school bee by doing this, and then you do those things. Then I'll get into state or win the state bee by doing these things. And then, yeah, just go step by step.
So I'm going to quiz you here, and you won't lose or win anything if you get these right or wrong. But the National Geographic posts 10 new geography questions a day online. And this is one from today. And by the way, I will say right at the outset, I definitely would not get these right, but you might. The Lempa River, which flows into the Pacific Ocean, provides hydroelectric power to which Central American country? Is it El Salvador, Guatemala, or Belize?
El Salvador.
You're right. You're right about that one. Here's another one. The Northern Territory's largest town south of the McDonnell Ranges was founded as a station on the Overland Telegraph Line in the late 1800s. Name this Australian town. Is it Perth, Canberra, or Alice Springs?
Alice Springs.
You got it right. I'm going to do one more, and I don't even know how to say some of these things, so I want to make sure I pronounce them properly, but the Sea of Azov, which borders Ukraine and Russia, is an inlet of which larger inland sea? The Red Sea, the Black Sea, or the Aral Sea?
The Black Sea.
Yep, you got it. See, you win our Geography B2. But unfortunately, we're not going to give you $50,000 for it. Venkat Ranjan, the winner of the National Geographic B, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can test your own geography knowledge. We have a link to the National Geographic's Daily Geography Quiz at hereandnow.org. Well, here's another question. If you're a meat eater, what do you know about the DNA of the animals behind the meat? Probably nothing. But it turns out more and more ranchers are DNA testing cattle to find out how they'll develop. Christopher Husted from Harvest Public Media reports.
About 100 people gather inside a large barn for a cattle auction in Salisbury, Missouri. They sit down in bleachers surrounding an auction ring. 88 cattle are up for sale today. Most will fetch a few thousand dollars. As the bull from Lot 20 is brought into the ring, the auctioneer describes it with words and numbers.
You want to let in this powerhouse Lot 20. You want to talk about a genetic masterpiece. He's a bull that's going to grow to the top 1% of the breed for wean weight and for yearling weight, for dollar beef, for carcass weight.
Genetics, top percentage points. This Lot 20 bull, named Southside, was DNA tested to see how he compares to others in the Angus breed. Next to his photo in the sales catalog is what looks like a baseball card. It includes his birth date, weight, and a chart of statistics from his DNA test.
He's Lot 20, he's a Southside son. I got to get on 2,500 bid. Now 7.5.
Ranchers have always analyzed how a prospective bull's progeny have developed over generations, but now science is gaining ground. The American Angus Association introduced a genomic testing kit in November. For $37 a pop, ranchers can send a tissue or blood sample in and receive a readout on how a bull's genetic makeup compares to others in the breed. All 88 cattle selling at the Salisbury auction had been tested. Kelly Ritalik is the genetic services director for the Angus Association's breeding arm. She says improving the quality of the beef is key.
Genomic testing allows us to basically find animals that are better for traits like marbling earlier, that have a bigger tendency to basically pass down those traits later on in life as parents. And so that's how we create a better product for the consumer.
Ritalik says the Angus Association has 467,000 genomic profiles of cattle to reference when it analyzes a DNA sample. Researchers help narrow in on traits that indicate which bulls would produce the fastest growing calves, which would grow the biggest ribeyes. Jared Decker is a cattle geneticist at the University of Missouri.
If we have a genomic-based, a DNA-based genetic prediction, there's less possibility for that genetic prediction to change as we get more data back on that animal. And so it's taking some of that risk out of the equation.
Predictability helps cut costs for ranchers. And down the line, that could mean lower prices for consumers, Decker says. But for the DNA test to be useful, ranchers have to benchmark their livestock with measurements and ultrasound scans that correspond to the DNA. Wes Thiemann is a cattle sales coordinator and producer from Central Missouri. He was running the auction in Salisbury.
If we're not turning in those weights and if we don't get that hard information, those scans, 5 years down the road, our DNA doesn't mean anything to us because the DNA has changed. These animals have changed and evolved through selection pressure.
Thiemann says more clients are asking about the genomics of cattle for sale every week, and he expects that to continue as the demand for beef grows. And that's the final piece of the picture. Across the globe, people are hungry for beef, quality beef. Coming down the pipeline, researchers are working on tailored DNA tests that can better predict how productive cattle will be in specific environments with humidity, elevation, or toxic vegetation.
Now 2.5, 9,000 bid. 9,250.
Back at the cattle auction in Salisbury, Missouri, hands shoot up and heads nod at the auctioneer for the bull named Southside. The price jumps up to 9,000, 10,000, 11,000.
Last call. Thank you for what you did do. At 11 time, getting a 12, getting a 12, getting a 12,000. So 11,500, 11,500.
Southside is the most expensive bull sold tonight. He'll head to a farm to breed for a rancher trying to grow the highest quality beef for the lowest input costs. And at next year's cattle auction, ranchers likely will have more traits available in each bull's genomic profile for decision-making. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Husted.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
Oil prices are rising, and experts say they could be at a four-year high later this summer. They're pointing to several factors: strong demand, falling global supply, and a number of geopolitical issues for the higher prices that you're seeing at the gas pump. But this is also a big deal for airlines and what they charge you for a ticket. American Airlines CEO Doug Parker said this weekend that the company will likely pass those costs on to customers if oil prices continue to climb. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News, and she's host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
The International Air Transport Association, it's a group that represents about 300 carriers, said this year is going to be less profitable than airlines expected, largely because of those fuel costs. So how closely are CEOs watching the price of oil?
Yeah, well, that's an important commodity to them. So we know that rising oil prices impacts jet fuel. And also, I should say that wages, both of those together, rising prices and wages, are putting pressure on the margins of these air carriers. Profits at the world's biggest airlines are expected to dip this year, and that is according to the IATA. They say the profit forecast for 2018, down by 12% from its December estimate, about $34 billion. So pretty good numbers, but it would represent a drop from 2017. That was a record profit year for the airlines, $38 billion.
So let's connect the dots. Does that mean that we're all going to be paying more next time we want to go somewhere?
Not necessarily. You know, I will say that while a lot of the airlines are warning about this, so far it hasn't been horrible. They've all penciled in somewhere a range, a 3 to 5% increase in on average in fares from 2017 to 2018. We know that from a lot of their earnings calls, so that's why we get that information. I should tell you there was this wild stat from that industry group. Round-trip airfare on average, before surcharges and tax, average, $380. Doesn't sound bad, right?
Yeah.
It's 59% below 1998 levels after you adjust for inflation.
Wow.
So that's amazing.
Well, I was going to ask you, you talk about how the margins are so tight. So, you know, are you implying that the airlines, if they're trying to find ways to cut costs in other places, that they're basically not going to be able to do it? I mean, they've kind of taken away everything. They've made their airplanes as light as possible. Is there anywhere else for them to make up ground?
Well, I think that there's this thing called load factor of each aircraft. And one of the reasons airlines have been so profitable and been able to kind of weather the slow increase in oil prices is that they increase the occupancy or the load factor of every aircraft. So that means...
Much to our displeasure, of course.
I was going to say, I am 5'11", so believe me, I feel this. This is rough. But they also have done things by decreasing the number of flights for small and medium-sized hubs. And so we know that the total number of scheduled departures in those small, medium-sized hubs have dropped by almost a third since 2005. So fuller flights, fewer flights. Yeah. This is not great for us.
Real quickly, Jill, Southwest Airlines says bookings have fallen in part because of that fatal accident back in April. How's Southwest doing?
Well, you know, look, the company said that the accident definitely made some people gun shy from buying flights, but bookings are worse than expected at Southwest. They are saying that is because of revenue trends and higher oil prices. We don't know. Hmm. That's what they tell us.
All right, Jill Schlesinger with CBS News. Thanks very much, as always.
Take care.
This week marks 50 years since Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. It was just after midnight on June 5, 1968. Kennedy, a U.S. senator from New York, had just won California's Democratic presidential primary. In his victory speech, he talked about trying to heal a divided country.
The divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a selfish country and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of the next year.
Minutes after wrapping up that speech, he was shot. He died the next day. Sirhan Sirhan was later convicted of the murder. He's serving life in prison. Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And let's go back to where this presidential run started 50 years ago. Kennedy had wrestled with the decision about whether to enter the presidential race. Why did he finally decide to do it?
That's right. He had been thinking about doing this for a while. He had been talking with friends and colleagues, but he was very hesitant to do it. Some things happen in early 1968 that increases motivation to run. The Tet Offensive in Vietnam, like many Americans, he is shattered by the news this war would be ongoing. The Kerner Commission report leads him to be triply concerned about the state of race relations in the United States. But then what happens is in March, during the New Hampshire primary, the other candidate who is competing against Lyndon Johnson, Eugene McCarthy, does pretty well, unexpectedly well in the primary. And this motivates RFK to believe that he can really compete against an incumbent president. So there's many parts of the mix that are at work.
And the incumbent president was Lyndon Johnson, who knew that he was in trouble when McCarthy did well in the New Hampshire primary. But when he said this on national TV on March 31st, 1968, people were shocked.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
That announcement was a surprise, Julian.
Oh, yeah, that was a jaw-dropping moment where the president goes on television. Nobody knows he's going to do this other than a small group of people who work with him. And he announces he's not going to run for re-election. And most people assume that he would. Most people still thought that even with the problems in 1968, he could be a pretty tough candidate. But he drops out and he says he's going to focus on ending the war. He's going to focus on making sure the Great Society is financed. But one thing he won't do is run. And all of a sudden, the field is wide open for people like Robert Kennedy, McCarthy, and others to actually compete.
But Johnson's vice president was Hubert Humphrey, right? Why wasn't he in the list that you just mentioned there?
Well, he becomes the establishment candidate, and the party is backing Humphrey, and the expectation is that he will do well, but no one's really excited about Hubert Humphrey. Even though there had been a moment in his career, he was the icon of liberalism. By 1968, he is being dragged down by the weight of Vietnam. And so Humphrey is the person who takes over the role Lyndon Johnson had. But there's a lot more excitement about Robert Kennedy, even about Eugene McCarthy, because they are standing firmly by that moment against the war in Vietnam. And Humphrey is not breaking with the administration on this war.
If Kennedy had not been killed, do you think he would have been the nominee of the Democratic Party?
It's hard to tell. This is one of the great what-ifs in political history, and many people think that he would have, especially after he wins in the California primary. But we do have to remember the party was going to back Hubert Humphrey, and I'm not convinced that it was automatic that Robert Kennedy would have a path to the nomination. Humphrey is a stalwart. He's been not only vice president, he's been a key senator. And a lot of the party still didn't want to break either with the Johnson administration's position on the Vietnam War. So I don't think it's clear what would have happened. And that's why it's one of these amazing what ifs to think about.
Well, we know what did happen. And he was killed, as we said, by Sirhan Sirhan. The Democratic Convention was held later that year in Chicago. It's clear at that point that Humphrey would be the nominee. But what people see on TV is the riots, police and protesters clashing in the streets. They're chanting, "The whole world is watching." And in his acceptance speech, Humphrey said it was a moment of personal pride, but he also said this.
"Yet one cannot help but reflect the deep sadness that we feel over the troubles and the violence which have erupted regrettably and tragically in the streets of this great city."
Humphrey later called the convention a catastrophe. Why?
Well, for many people who were watching it, it looked like the Democratic Party was out of control. They had been watching the fights within the party for a long time now, with all the anti-war protests and the tensions between Democrats. But here it played out right on television. And you had the police in a city that was run by one of the most prominent Democrats, Mayor Daley. Mm-hmm. The Democrats are inside trying to create order. And outside on the streets, there are police clashing with protesters. And the protesters are angry, not with the Republicans, but with the Democrats for not going strong against the Vietnam War. So this was the worst image for Humphrey to showcase at the convention. This looked like a party that was literally falling apart at the end of this turbulent decade.
And at that time of the convention, Richard Nixon had already secured the Republican nomination. Here he is in his acceptance speech in Miami.
"And tonight it's time for some honest talk about the problem of order in the United States. Let us always respect, as I do, our courts and those who serve on them. But let us also recognize that some of our courts, in their decisions, have gone too far in weakening the peace forces as against the criminal forces in this country."
You hear him talking about the criminal forces. Richard Nixon basically ran a law and order campaign and won the presidency.
That's exactly right. He does promise that he's going to bring an end to Vietnam in a very vague fashion. But the theme he really hones in on is law and order. And the law and order plays well to what people had seen in the Chicago convention, meaning it seemed like a lot of disorder. It seemed like a lot of lawlessness. And he appeals to what will be called the silent majority, saying he will move the country in a different direction. And he will focus less on what the Supreme Court had been focused on, which is talking about rights of people who are arrested, rights of criminals. And instead, he will turn attention to cracking down on everything that people were watching. And it's a very effective campaign and in many ways defines some of the themes of conservatism for the next few decades.
Julian, I was not alive in 1968, but I've certainly learned a lot in my life about that year, about Robert F. Kennedy, about Martin Luther King, and all the other things that were going on at that time. I wonder, though, given what's happening right now politically, whether you think that what happened in 1968 feels as momentous as it used to.
I think it does. And looking back at that year, it is actually a reminder of some of the more chaotic and unstable moments we've gone through politically. And for different reasons, today many people focus on the president himself and the kind of presidency he's conducting, whereas back in 68, it's even broader than that. With all the social conflict that's unfolding, and some of the instability with our institutions, and of course this war, which is massive and it's a total disaster in the minds of many people. So for me, I look back and it doesn't diminish how bad things got, but it's a reminder that we go through moments like these, and they're very difficult. The good news is we can move forward, and our institutions are able to recover from this. It's not guaranteed, but it should offer a little insight into how that happens.
That's Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, also author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Julian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For many years, coats made from animal fur have been highly prized. And if you think those days are over, they are not. The most coveted fur of all is bobcat fur from the American West. But Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edward reports a live bobcat might be worth more than its pelt.
Riverton, Wyoming trapper Tom Krause shows me around his workshop where furs of every sort are displayed on the wall.
I have some pelts here that...
Yeah, what do you have here?
You might be interested in that are a little bit different. To begin, I have a melanistic phase of raccoon, which is a black...
Ermine, wolverine, lynx. Krause has furs from all over the world. He's been trapping since he was 13. In his 30s, he made a living as a trapper, and it's always supplemented his income. And then there's the bobcat.
So this animal here is well spotted throughout the whole body.
Yeah.
And has a broad, deep belly. So this is one of the more valuable bobcats.
And Krause is coming off a productive winter. He trapped 13 bobcats.
I had some pretty nice bobcat pelts this year, and my average price on that was $400.
13 pelts at $400 a pop. That means Krause made about $5,300 this year on bobcat pelts. A beaver pelt goes for $8. Coyotes, maybe $50. Krause says sometimes fur buyers even pay as much as $1,000 for an extra special bobcat pelt. It's the only spotted feline that's still legal to trap in the world. And Wyoming's bobcats are soft, while those in other places like the Midwest and the South are wiry. It takes about 30 bobcat bellies to make a coat. Krause shows me one he had made for his wife.
When I had this made, it was appraised at $3,500. Today, it would be worth more, maybe twice that much.
Internationally, bobcat coats can sell for $100,000.
If people have a lot of money, want to really be flashy and show their money, a bobcat belly garment is attractive and valuable to some of those people.
A recent study, though, says that Wyoming could be making much more on bobcats by leaving them alone. Lisa Robertson is the president of Wyoming Untrapped. She came up with the idea of putting a dollar value on live animals while watching a wild bobcat hunt fish on a Wyoming river.
There was a BBC photographer there as well, and he'd been there for 2 weeks photographing. And we sort of worked together, finding the bobcat, watching it, and we realized this is a very valuable bobcat.
Tourists made trips to Wyoming to photograph the Madison River bobcat that winter. So Robertson started reaching out to wildlife watchers to see how much they'd spent in Wyoming on such trips, on hotel stays, restaurants, gas money.
The number we came up with this Bobcat for just those 3 months, for just those people we contacted, was $308,105. And in a market where tourism is the second largest industry in Wyoming and generates $3.2 billion a year, that's a remarkable number for one single animal.
$300,000 for one bobcat. Comparatively, Robertson found that a trapper making a trip to kill one animal only brings in a little more than $300 for the state's economy. And Robertson says trapping them is also inhumane. To preserve their pelts, bobcats are choked to death rather than killed with a gunshot. And in Wyoming, trappers only have to check their traps every 3 days.
When there are cold temperatures and it's minus 10 degrees, minus 20, you know, that bobcat cannot feel its paw. There's a good chance it's going to bite that foot off or rip it off.
Because of such cruelty, many animal rights groups condemn trapping altogether. Wyoming Untrapped is no different, but recognizes the need for incremental changes, too. Robertson says the group would like to see Wyoming require trappers to check every 24 hours instead of every 72. And Robertson says with the value of bobcat pelts so high, Wyoming Game and Fish Department needs to set a limit on how many bobcats can be taken a year. 10 years ago, more than 3,000 bobcats were trapped. Last year, about 1,400, only half as many.
I think there are more trappers in recent years, and they're catching actually less bobcat, which means to me that there just aren't as many bobcats out there.
Yet a 2010 Fish and Wildlife Management study shows that bobcat numbers are actually increasing in most states, including Wyoming. Out in his garage, trapper Tom Krause is demonstrating how a number two foothold trap works.
So this trap will be staked solidly in the ground and then covered with dirt. But I'll go ahead and spring this trap now.
Krause wrote a handbook on how to safely and more humanely trap, including following regulations very carefully.
Yeah, they can be over-harvested. That's possible.
He says that means releasing females and kittens.
I think it's really good, too, that we do harvest and pursue some wildlife because it keeps them wild and they get smarter and the genetics are passed on.
Wildlife advocates aren't convinced. The Center for Biological Diversity says the international fur market is hurting North American wildlife and recently filed suit in California to make trapping illegal and another in Montana to stop fur exporting. Both cases are moving forward. For Here and Now, I'm Melody Edwards.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.